Public Safety Subcommittee for Monday, April 11th, 2005. We're going to shift the agenda and start with House Bill 5016, the Department of Corrections. And then as soon as we have a quorum present, we will go back to the Department of Justice and take up a matter there for a few minutes, and then come back to the Department of Corrections. May I call up Stan Zerniak and Sue Aka? And Mr. Williams, are you joining your team this morning?
I am.
Okay.
That's all right, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Make yourself dispensable. You don't have to do this. The first thing you have to do.
Right.
And may I say to the Attorney General this morning, this afternoon, we appreciate your patience before we get back to the other matters.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we're pleased to be back before you again in our Phase 2 presentation. After consultation with staff on Thursday and recognizing that the committee is operating under a fairly constrained timeline to move through our presentation and prepare for the public testimony regarding the DOC budget on Wednesday, we are going to do our best to expedite our presentation over the next 2 days. To just give you a brief roadmap, we're hopeful that Mr. Zerniak will be able to complete his presentation on the Operations Division today, and with us is Ginger Martin, the Assistant Director of Transitional Services, who will then present as well, and then we would hopefully complete that, if not today, then tomorrow, and then also present to you our General Services, Human Resources, and the Administrative portion of the budget, along with commentary by Ms. Acuff on the impact of the co-chair's various recommended proposals on our budget impact.
Very good.
It's a lot to cover in 2 days. And with that in mind, I would invite the committee, if you have particular questions, but you're not interested in necessarily slowing us down or spending the committee time in consultation, but you'd still like us to follow up on something, we will make ourselves available immediately after committee to respond to any questions or anything you'd like us to do. You have also in front of you, I think Mr. Wilson's distributing. These are the responses to the questions that were asked of us on Thursday, where we agreed to provide you some form of response. We think it's going to be more effective of the committee's time to provide you written responses to your questions, so we're not backtracking and covering some of the same material a second time. Again, as with all the information we've presented, if any of the committee members have questions they'd like us to address, either here in committee or individually in our offices, we'll certainly make ourselves available to provide you as much information as we can. So with that, Madam Chair, unless there's anything further, I'd ask Mr. Zerniak to take off where we left off, which was on page 14 of your operations division presentation in your notebook.
Good afternoon, and please take us forward.
Chair Gorley and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Stan Zerniak. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. We left off on Thursday in the area of rental beds. What I'd like to tell you about that is that currently we have contracts for 80 rental beds in three Oregon counties. These include Douglas, Linn, and Grant counties. To be eligible for placement in a rental bed, inmates must be 60 days from release. They must not have any major disciplinary problems or any major issues in the area of medical or mental health. And these criteria are necessary to help counties meet our target rate of $60 per day. Additional costs may be incurred by the Department of Corrections should an inmate in a rental bed incur a major medical issue. Please turn to page 15.
Mr. Zerniak, what was that number that you started with? Was that 880?
I'm sorry, Chair Gorley, that was 80.
80.
Currently, right.
Okay.
And we can give you a breakdown of that if you like later. The fourth unit I'd like to discuss with the committee is the Chief of Security, which obviously has a major, major role in ensuring that we meet our primary mission of protecting the public and running safe and secure institutions for our staff and inmates. The Chief Security's unit is responsible for the Inmate Transport Unit Institutional Readiness, which is broken down into the Statewide Security Auditing Program, the Statewide Security Threat Group Management Program, the Tactical Emergency Response Teams, and the Crisis Negotiation Teams, which in other states are referred to as Hostage Negotiation Teams, and the Emergency Staff Support System, as well as the Emergency Coordinators throughout the system. Just to give you some brief context, since 1996, the Tactical Emergency Response Teams have been activated a total of 21 times in response to events ranging from executions to inmate disturbances. In the past 2 years alone, these teams were activated 7 times. 5 of these were in response to inmate group disturbances at 4 separate institutions, once in response to an inmate murder, and once in response to an attempted inmate suicide. The Chief Security's unit also is responsible for providing the mandated inmate mail service, which includes legal mail, correspondence, and publications. To give you some context, we handle over 26,000 pieces of mail each day for inmates, and each piece of this mail has to be inspected for contraband, and we have as a goal to get this inmate mail processed and delivered to the respective inmate within 2 days. I'd like to now talk about the inmate work program, which is the 5th of 6 operations division units. This unit is responsible for overseeing the Prison Reform and Inmate Work Act of 1994, referred to as Measure 17. All eligible inmates are required to work and be in the program assignments 40 hours a week. We currently have inmate crew work contracts with several federal agencies, such as the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In addition, we have work projects with over 65 public and state agencies, such as fire departments, Department of Transportation, DAS, and the military department. In addition, we have inmates that work for 30 private or nonprofit and 78 community service partnerships throughout the state. And these include things such as the Oregon Food Bank, Adopt a Highway Program, and others. Please turn to page 18. We have a major partnership.
Mr. Zerniak, let me stop you here just for a moment. I need to go back to the security threat group management just for a moment. Is that, or the tactical emergency response teams, rather, those teams, are they trained also through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training?
Chair Gordon, those teams, we provide the training for those teams. That is not part of the DPSST training.
Why, Madam Chair?
Representative Wisnat.
Why not?
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnat, I'm not really sure. I think the DPSST does the original upfront training for our officers, and then we take the training beyond that to provide training for special teams.
Representative Wisnat?
Madam Chair, it's another example where I think we really need to see why we can't put more and more of that training if we're building that facility in there. You're saying your people receive 120 hours of training and 96 hours on an annual basis. I can see maybe the 96 annual training, but it looks like the 120 hours should be done at DP, our public safety training center.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnat.
I'm going to ask you to hold your thought.
Okay.
Because I'd like to make a transition here and go back to the first item on the agenda, which is the Department of Justice. That'll give Director Wims and Mr. Zerniak some more moments to consider their response.
Would you like to clear us to clear out of the table?
Okay.
That would be desirable. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5016 and open the hearing on House Bill 5044, the Department of Justice. I'm going to ask Attorney General Myers to please come up, and anyone else that you would like to join you from the department. Mr. Wilson, if you would walk us through legal rate.
I think.
And
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, could I introduce two people in the audience while they're coming forward?
Certainly.
There's two people here, both educators. I'm going to mispronounce this name for sure, but Tom Piawati and Mark Martins. Mark is with Tualatin High School, and Tom is with Malala. They're both in the leadership program at PSU, working to be future school administrators.
Excellent. Welcome. And please come closer so that you can hear and fully experience the work of the committee.
Probably Presbyterians or Baptists.
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, what you have in front of you are two pieces that are probably under your agenda somewhere next to you that I've prepared. We don't anticipate any formal presentation by the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, and I'll go through my things, and then we will have a work session. Going first to the non-number page, just some reminders to the subcommittee members. The hourly rate is based on the costs of a set number of attorney generals, or really a set number of assistant attorney generals, who bill state agencies and others, including internally the Department of Justice, for their legal services. The rate must cover the cost of the attorney, selected support staff, as well as other costs that aren't attributed to staff specifically, but include things like rent and accounting and their share of the department-wide cost, the Department of Justice. In the rate that is being proposed to you today, you're talking just over 200 FTE of attorney billers. The rate, as I said before, is used to charge against agencies. It's also used to charge internally for the appeals division, trial divisions, and other functions. So they do charge things like the Defense of a Criminal Appeals Fund for the services at the same rate they charge state agencies. Think of the rate as a per unit cost. It must be sufficient to cover the cost of the agency. And many of these costs are, I'm not going to say beyond the control of the agency, but they're relatively fixed, meaning most of the costs are based on personnel costs, as well as things like rent and other agency-wide costs. So the department itself, while it can control the number of hours and stuff to a point, they really have to make sure they have enough to cover the cost of the program, or cost of the attorneys and the support staff. The legislature approves expenditure limitation. What you're doing here is sort of, for a lack of a better term, blessing the rate. It has been run by the co-chairs, and then each agency's budget, not only in this subcommittee, but in all subcommittees, will be adjusted during work sessions, and for those that have already been work session, will catch up toward the end of session with a sort of a catch-all bill for those agencies. But they'll all be adjusted in terms of their general fund or their expenditure limitations and other funding federal funds to catch up on what rate is blessed by this committee. The amount of staff required by DOJ, which the basis the rate is assumed, varies from the demand for services. So really, the rate you're setting today or blessing today is an assumed rate. The Attorney General in practice does not change that rate, and it is hoped that it will cover the costs of the services that are demanded. When the Department of Justice presents the rate in the governor's budget process, it's made very early, and in practice the governor does not adjust that rate in his process and leaves it to the legislature to change and alter. So the governor, the Department of Justice submitted a rate to the governor's budget process of $119 per hour, which is significantly more through the process that you're going to get to today than they will end up with based on your decisions. But keep in mind, the governor doesn't have an inflated rate. It's based on a whole number of factors that have changed during the governor's budget process, as well as changed even since the governor's budget process. In the past, this rate has subsidized other functions of the agency. About two biennia ago, was discontinued, and the rate now is established to just fund the legal services of the agency, both from internal and external demand for services. And the last rate there, or the last number or bullet, talks about the history. It was $97 in 01-03, $98 in 03-05, the current biennium. But please keep in mind that the current biennium was assumed with lots of wage freezes, PERS rate reductions, no merit increases built into the budget. And since this is really a personnel-driven rate and budget, those costs did not go up. That is different for this biennium that we're looking at now in 05-07, where LFO is recommending a rate of $111 per hour. The governor's budget assumes $119 per hour. And both of the budgets of the co-chairs, that's the way we're saying it now, I'm not sure, both assume a little bit over $2 million of general fund savings from this rate decrease. So if you turn to the second page, I'll quickly go through this. I've met with some of the members of the subcommittee with this sheet. Others, like Representative Hansen and Senator Devlin, have done this before. So I thought your experience probably did not mean me sitting down to remind you. At the top of the page, a rate of 98.08, that is the sort of the close of session rate from this current biennium on 03-05. There were changes made for changes in assumptions for vacancies and changing in staff. What really happens here is a decrease in revenue. Adjustments, the department had proposed something in terms of an emergency board adjustment. Our recommendation from LFO is that you don't make that adjustment, so you don't see it there. It had dealt with some health benefits in 05 or in 03-05 that were added, but those had already been included in the creation of the budget, so they were not needed. The next line, which is one of the larger increases, is the built-in salary increases from PICS, which is the Position Inventory Control System. This is what is basically automatic increases for second merits, roll up the cost of living adjustments, of which there weren't necessarily any roll up this time, and an estimate, early on estimate for health benefits. And as you'll notice when we get down the page a little further, there will be some more health benefit adjustments. Phase in and phase outs, and finally the last entry in that top box is the net cost of the pension obligation bonds in this biennium. And there's a roll up in this biennium, mainly because the pension obligation bond payments in 03-05 did not start until, I believe, May of 2004, so there's 10 months of roll-up, so increased costs. In turn, that provides you a base budget. Moving on to the adjustments, there are an assumption made that employee compensation will increase. DAS has included in the emergency fund $130 million in part, which assume a 2+2% increase July 1 of each fiscal year of the new biennium, and that is assumed in here. That doesn't necessarily mean what the final negotiations with the Department of Justice and their representative organizations will be, but this is what is assumed in the budget. Health benefit increases, this is an updated rate. Another $1 million of cost. This is more recent data, but it still may not be the final costs, but we'll not know sort of 2007 costs to the exact dollar until later in the biennium. The next item is a decrease, which is offsetting revenue. These are revenues collected from other programs in the department to offset the agency-wide costs, so it lowers the rate. The next is an increase due to federal requirements about the size of ending balances. The federal government, as I understand it, only allows for sufficient funding in terms of federal funds for 1 month of ending balance, which is not very long when you're depending on your ending balance to carry you from more than 1 month of operation. The ending balance assumed in this rate is roughly 2 months. I'll use the term roughly. I think it's a little under 2 months, if I'm not mistaken. The decrease in the PERS employee contribution, brings us up to date for the most recent PERS board's actions in the past couple months. There are some increases due to the salary structure within the Department of Justice and your senior assistant attorney generals. This has been made in the past. They are working now with DAS to try to sort of fix this for one time, but until they fix it or adjust it, it has to keep being made as an adjustment in the rate. There is a rent increase assumed in here for the new space and the renovated space in the Commerce and Justice buildings. Please keep in mind that the Department of Justice is absorbing, I believe it's over $700,000 of fixed or one-time costs. All they're asking for here is the ongoing rental costs. And finally, the impact of the various policy packages in the governor's budget is listed there. It has very little impact because you're increasing the costs of the new attorneys, but also they are able to bill your increasing revenues. And the largest package here is the DHS, Department of Human Services, child welfare budget that both the department here and Department of Human Services has testified in support of. And finally, there's the smart buy savings. So given all that, you come up with a rate of $111. Either round up or down generally to make it easier on agents. So it's $111. And at the below there, I list some unknowns, the impact of labor negotiations, impact of health benefit costs later in the biennium, what policy packages are approved or non-approved won't affect the rate significantly or the costs, but it does sort of affect the number of attorneys. The number of actual vacancies versus the assumed vacancies can have some uncertainty put into this process, as well as any other actions taken by the legislature that affects basic costs across state government. So what might happen, for example, if the Ways and Means Committee, Subcommittee for General Government made significant changes to DAS, that would not necessarily be picked up in this rate, but there are a number of other unknowns that I would hate to try to anticipate them all and adjust the rate for that. Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chair, our recommendation is a final rate of $111.
Senator Devlin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson and Mr. Attorney General, can you give us a couple of examples of what offsetting revenue collected? It's about halfway down the entire page. What some examples of that would be? Yes.
Madam Chair, Michael Norton from our office.
Certainly, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Senator Devlin, the figure that you're referring to is the $3,095,000 figure?
Yes.
The central administration for the entire agency resides within the legal fund, but other programs in the Department of Justice outside the legal fund pay their representative portion of those costs. For example, the Division of Child Support is not in the legal fund. The amount that is collected to administer all of the agency's programs over and above what's required is given as a credit to the rate, since the costs for those services reside in the legal fund. So if we collect from the Division of Child Support, from crime victims, from consumer protection, their portion of accounting costs, payroll costs, information services costs, it's a credit to the legal fund.
Clarification.
Certainly.
So this is simply past practice also. You're just simply, they're paying their normal costs. By doing this, you're in no way increasing their costs for some of those other entities.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, no, not in any way. This actually is a favorable credit to the rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Representative Wisner.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Wilson came by and gave me a briefing and went through it, but one thing I didn't, the $89 million that we're starting with, That's there's this normal salaries and benefits in that 89, or were we looking anything out of the ordinary in the 89 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, that is basically when they left last session, roughly 2 years ago, that was the base that they left with. So it includes the salaries and all the costs associated for the 194 billers, the costs, and plus some of the other support. So it's sort of the starting point. It doesn't include anything that they didn't, weren't already approved by the 2003 legislature.
Thank you.
Further comments or questions? Anything else from the agency?
I'm sorry, reopen.
just the real basic question. Attorney General Myers, do you support this action, and can you make your agency work using this set of assumptions?
Madam Chair, Representative Henson, yes. If I could just put out that comment, as I think mentioned in my closing comments to the subcommittee, and I think several members were delayed getting here, so something didn't hear, but insofar as the unknowns with respect to personnel costs in this coming biennium are concerned, my desire is simply to have the Department of Justice treated the same as other agencies in the government insofar as what part of those costs might the agencies have to absorb for themselves as opposed to being funded by the legislature or by the rate. And thus, as Mr. Wilson has said, there are some unknowns that could ultimately put the department in a better or worse condition than other agencies. If we're in a better condition, it would be my intention to lower the rate, quite frankly. So it's parity that I'm hoping to achieve ultimately in relation to all of the rest of the government.
Representative Woodstock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we approve this rate, do the other agencies get notified? Because did they base it upon the governor's 119 or some of their...
Madam Chair, Representative Lieutenant, your LFO recommendations that we'll have for every other agency will include a number to adjust both general fund, other, and federal funds.
So my question, Madam Chair, is we're going to have more money than some of them?
Madam Chair, Representative Lieutenant, the co-chair's budget, as I mentioned, includes a little over $2 million general fund savings, and then all the other, for example, in other funds, the expenditure limitation will be adjusted, and they just won't spend that amount.
Thank you.
Chair, clarification also. In terms of this issue, are we making a recommendation to the full? Is that usual, or is it simply here?
Madam Chair, Senator.
And it will be reflected in their budget.
It's usually here. The tradition has been for this subcommittee to review it, and then it's really all the other adjustments that are implementing it to the other agencies.
Okay. Madam Chair, as soon as you go into work session.
All right. We're sure. Okay. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 5044 and open the work session on House Bill 5044. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the recommendation from the Legislative Fiscal Office prepared by and presented by Mr. Wilson of $111 for the 0507 biennium for Attorney General's fees.
Is there any objection? Representative Hanson.
Should that be $111.04?
No, it would be $111. It would take DAS more than 4 cents to compute that. I'm just kidding. It's $111.
Senator Devlin moves the recommendation from Legislative Fiscal Office prepared by Mr. Wilson, setting the final legal rate and cost at $111.04.
$111 is the motion.
$111. Any objection? Okay. So ordered. And we will reopen the hearing on House Bill 5016 and ask the Department of Corrections to come back. And we were about to hear your response on the training provided to the Tactical Emergency Response Teams for CHERCH.
Chair Gardley and members of the committee, again, I'm Stan Zerniak, Assistant Director for Operations, Department of Corrections. I think the answer lies in the different missions between what you would find typical in terms of an emergency and a correctional institution versus what you would find out in the community. The kinds of training that we provide our tactical emergency response teams gears very heavily on institutional-specific type circumstances, such as inmate barricades, hostage situations, disturbances, and the like. And I think that the rules of engagement probably are quite a bit different from what you would find out in an open community versus what we can do in corrections.
Representative Lisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we're having a tough time, especially a new member of the public safety, is trying to figure out why we have a consolidated training facility that everyone's doing their own training, and that's what we're having problems with. I guess, Madam Chair, my question to the Department of Corrections staff would be, you know, do you have people dedicated to training, and how much money is that costing us, and do you have hours devoted that's in the budget for training, and how much is that costing us? And you know, especially even your crisis negotiating team people, I would think, hopefully, pray God, that they don't get used much. So I'm assuming they have other jobs instead of just, they don't just sit there and wait for use their expertise.
Chair Gorley and Representative Wisnat, that is absolutely correct. And all the teams that I mentioned to you, those individuals have other jobs. We only pull them out of those jobs for training and for actual emergencies.
Madam Chair.
Please continue.
Thank you. Follow up, Dennis. Could you expand in? So you don't have dedicated training staff set aside to train these people, or is not a budget item that's been devoted to training for your people?
Chair Gorley and Representative Wisnat, I'd have to get some clarification from the actual training department as to how they deliver that training and how they're, I think some of those may be some full-time trainers. Some of those are individuals that have other jobs also that are pulled out for training purposes. But I don't have an actual breakdown for you right now, but we could get that.
It would be very helpful, following up on Representative Wisnat's request, to get a description of the content of the tactical emergency response team training, the content as well as who provides the training, how it's delivered, and in addition to that, what is the specific training provided to corrections officers at the DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, so that we can compare and contrast, if you will. Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, in addition to that, those questions, I want to indicate for the record that there is some discussion and some disagreement in the committee over the issue of training. Personally, I recognize that all public safety entities are going to have some training that is internal and that will not be provided by PP, the Board of Police Standards, Safety and Training. We are going to change that name. And that it's not impractical in a lot of cases for that training to be provided through that facility, given what the impact would be in terms of costs of transfer or of having personnel off hours, paying per diems, sending them to Salem. But in terms of the basic training, I think an interesting question in the Board of Police Standards, Safety and Training would be, I believe, and if people would nod their head if I'm correct, the basic is 5 weeks, I believe. And how that compares to national standards for training for correctional officers, and whether or not the feeling of the department is that that is sufficient or more training of a basic nature needs to be done through the Board of Police Standards, Safety and Training.
Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we would be pleased to respond to both those issues to provide you some information, both with respect to the content of the training and some comparisons of other national training. I think it would be crazy for any of us, I think, to sit here and say that 5 weeks of training, given the field of work and the endeavor and the kind of population that these people are asked to deal with, would be a sufficient amount. We would love to have more training, both external at DPSST and internal, and we recognize that that's primarily a function of resource, and we attempt to prioritize our training resources where we think they're going to make the most impact. One of the challenges, obviously, with our TERT teams is that they're designed specifically to respond on to institution-specific events. And so much of the training that they do is actually on the grounds of the institution. They will do emergency drills at the institution. They will close particular housing units, and they will drill on how they would gain access to that housing unit if there was an inmate disturbance specifically. Some of it through, you know, to respect the confidentiality of some of the information, but it's a lot of it's very sensitive about how they train to specifically respond to an institutional threat if there was, in fact, either a riot or a significant disturbance where hostages were taken, either staff or other inmates. And so it does require that they do some of that training at a minimum on the ground at the facility where they can actually train in the very corridors and in the very shafts and other areas where they actually have to do that work. And that would just not be able to be traditionally replicated at a training site at DPSST. Some of the other training that's done, obviously, with some of the more instructional stuff as well as firearms and some of that stuff could be taught probably just about anywhere.
I would just add that I don't know that I agree with Senator Devlin so much about a disagreement among members about the training pieces. I believe what I've heard is more of a desire by the members of the Public Safety Subcommittee to a desire to more fully understand what is being provided and where and what additional training may be needed or required. There's a concern that in a question about whether we are providing enough resources to support the professional development of staff. That's the overarching concern I've heard from the committee, just to clarify.
Sure, and we'll be most pleased to provide you all of the information that you've requested.
Thank you. Please continue.
Chair Gorley and members of the committee, please, I think we left off on page 18. I just want to mention very quickly that the mobile work camp at the Deschutes camp has been awarded two prestigious awards. One is the in the year 2001, a Caring for the Land Award was presented by the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Deschutes National Forest. In 2002, we received the Honor Award, Special Honor Award, from the Secretaries of Agriculture and the Interior. In addition to these camps, we have 300 inmates who are currently trained as firefighters, 130 inmates additionally who are trained in camp and food services support, and since 2001, we have provided over 48,000 lunches to the firefighting effort throughout the state of Oregon. The next unit I'd like to talk to you about is the Operations Policy Management Unit, and that includes the duties of that unit include Division Budget Management and Analysis, Operations Division Legislative Support, automation that is critical to efficient and effective operation of institutions such as a visitor tracking system, and policy development and implementation, and we're also responsible for the inmate legal library services. I'd like to talk now about budget drivers and environmental factors, and basically it would be a repeat of most of the stuff that I've already talked about in terms of additional numbers of inmates coming into the system, the need to rent jail beds, the addition of housing units at existing institutions, and certainly the new construction requests that are contained in Senate Bill 5531, and the maintenance of 977 temporary beds for males and 74 temporary beds for females that we currently have as characterized by emergency beds. Please turn to page 20. Inmates needing special services and housing will continue to become greater. I'm going to give you some statistics on that. Since November 2004, our mental health caseload has grown by 300 inmates to over 2,800 inmates as of March 1st. In February alone, we received over 110 inmates that were diagnosed with moderate to severe mental illness. In addition, the inmates that are aged 50 and over will bring with those ages increase chronic illnesses such as hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, respiratory illness, arthritis, etc. Giving you again some information on that, 10 years ago we had 453 inmates in our system that were age 50 or above. So and that represented 6.2% of our population at that time. 10 years later, that 453 has grown to 1,508, or now consists of 11.8%. That is to say that one in eight inmates currently in the Oregon Department of Corrections is 50 years or older, and brings with them, again, those additional health care needs and the related costs. In addition, the growth of security threat groups in our system has been substantial. We had 875 known security threat group members in 1999. We're projecting that by the end of this coming biennium, that number will be over 1,400. An additional budget factor will certainly be the recruitment, staffing, and training associated with opening new prisons, operating existing prisons with emergency beds. Like to know.
Mr. Zerniak, the information on page 20 indicates that the annual cost of incarcerating the elderly population averages $60,000 to $70,000. What is the $10,000? What are the variables there?
Chair Gord, I'd have to get the specific information on that for you. I just assume that that has to do with the nature of the different types of illnesses that inmates that are 50 years and older have.
Yeah, I don't want to make the assumption. I would like us to know what that is.
Chair Gord, we'll certainly get that information for you.
Together with the total cost currently for housing, managing that 1,508 population.
Sure, Riley, we'll get that for you. I'd like to talk about professional services and purchasing contracts. These are primarily initiated and processed through the General Services Division. Generally, these include physical plant needs that are beyond the scope of our current staff to take care of. And this will include things such as elevator repair, asbestos abatement, and some electrical needs that are beyond the capability of some of our electricians. We also, in the health services area, have some part-time specialty contracts in the areas of orthopedics, ophthalmology, and NAPCARE, which is the on-site dialysis provider that I referred to earlier in this presentation. Please turn to page 22 to talk about some cost control measures. We are going to continue to apply the security staffing standards that we developed in the 1999-2001 biennium. We're also implementing the non-security staffing standards that were made a part of a budget note during the last biennium. We're going to be migrating to the electronic legal library system to avoid the cost of transporting inmates to other institutions when we don't have the library needs at one institution that they need. And we're going to be expanding our regional hospital watch concept. In the area of health services, we're going to be doing everything we can to control the costs that we have control over. There are some costs that we have no control over, such as the number and health status of inmates who come to the system. Whatever comes to us, we're going to have to deal with whatever ailments they bring with them. And we also have limited control over the kinds of procedures that we provide. And this is largely prescribed through constitutional issues, community standards of care, and also court cases that have been decided throughout the country. We do retain control, however, over the system of delivering health services, which includes some purchasing decisions. In this light, the control measures implemented by the Department of Corrections are industry-wide recognized best practices to manage health care costs and include a prioritized and limited list of health coverage and dental coverage, mental health coverage, and pharmaceuticals. Now, obviously, we're going to provide an appendectomy if that's required, but we won't provide procedures such as cosmetic nasal reconstruction surgery. In addition to the guidelines for treatment and use of diagnostic services, we have a physician's committee that does case-by-case assessments of treatment needs and makes decisions on what type of treatment that we're going to provide. I talked earlier about the medical pharmacy formularies and the algorithm, so I won't go into that again. But I will tell you that we do pay reduced rates at our hospitals. We have negotiated rates with specialists. Thank you. And we have a drug utilization review committee that maintains awareness of drug availability and effectiveness and cost changes to keep us up with the state of the art in terms of medications and cost effectiveness, as well as effectiveness of those drugs. As Director Williams pointed out earlier, the Department of Corrections is a member of a multi-state group for purchasing of medications. This is a consortium of 42 states who participate in group purchasing partnerships, and this membership is free to us and saves us quite a bit of money on our medications. Also, inmates who can afford it and have the means, they do purchase their own glasses, dentures, and prosthetics. For those inmates that don't have the means, the Department of Corrections will supply those items if they are needed. Please turn to page 24.
Before we go to 24, going back to the cost control measures, what is the savings in that shift that you're making to the electronic legal library services?
Chair Gorley, I know we've got that information. I'll get that for you. I know it's over $1 million, but we'll get the specific for you.
And if you could also identify the savings in each of those three bulleted categories under institutions. You're calling them cost control measures, so what does that mean in terms of what has actually been realized in savings? Or if their projected savings indicate that as well.
Okay, Chair Gordon, just to make sure I'm tracking, I'm trying to find what you're referring to exactly.
Under on page 22, cost control measures.
Right, okay.
You have three bullets under institutions.
Right, Chair Gordon, we'll get that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, performance measures. We have increased our target for Measure 17 compliance for the coming biennium to 80% from 78%. And we've done this with the realization that this is going to be an even more difficult standard for the Department of Corrections to meet, in that not only have we lost some programs, particularly work-based education programs that will help keep inmates productively involved in programming, but with the nearly 1,000 emergency beds that we have throughout the system, it's going to be more and more difficult to find meaningful work activities for inmates to do. However, we're going to certainly look at some strategies to do that. Another issue that's kind of makes it more complex for us to meet that level of compliance is that with the increased numbers of mental health inmates in the system, quite frankly, some of these inmates just can't handle 40 hours of productive activity. And we're looking at ways that we can possibly do some exemptions around that, still have them involved to the capacity that they can be involved, but not have the same standard as far as 100% compliance.
Mr. Zerniak, how was the initial target set in 2003, the 76%? What was that based on?
Chair Gorley and members of the committee, I'd have to hazard a guess on that, and I'd like to just go ahead and get that information from people that were involved in that decision at that time. I know there was some sort of assessment, and I think it probably had something to do with the number of meaningful jobs that we had at the time, also the inmates that were available that could, in fact, handle those kind of responsibilities.
And so what percentage, again, just so I'm sure I understand what you're saying, what percentage of the of inmates cannot work because of mental health challenges?
Chair Gorley, we're going to have to get that information for you. It really is a matter of degree, because some may be able to work 5 hours a week, some may be able to work 10 or 15 hours a week. And I'm just really not sure at this time.
So, but just so that we're clear, the performance measure, this performance measure is based on the number of inmates who can actually work.
That is correct, Chair Gorley.
As opposed to the total number of inmates. I think you need to do some disaggregating.
Right. What happens is that there are a number of inmates at any given time that, although they're eligible to work, they may not be able to work because they're either temporarily in an infirmary or a hospital, or they're temporarily in a confinement unit, or they're temporarily on a loss of privilege, or for whatever reason, they're just not able to work at that time.
I would encourage what I would like to see is disaggregation based by education as well as work. Those are two different activities.
Madam Chair, if I could interject, in a question that we received during our Phase 1 presentation, we provided a letter to the committee, members of the committee, on February 24, 2005, and the number 5 response to that letter is what categories and how many inmates are excluded from the work requirements of Ballot Measure 17, and we provided you a breakdown of that, and based also on the number of individuals who were exempt out based on categories of either being not currently in our physical possession because they've been sent out to court, security limitations if they were in IMU or DSU, medical exemptions, and then inmates who were recently transferred in who are still going through the period of analysis to determine at the institution level which appropriate work opportunity would be there. But we can certainly get you another copy of the February 24th letter if you'd like us to. But I think
no, I'm not asking for another copy of the report. What I'm asking for, and I'm not making myself clear, so let me try again. The performance measure needs to be based on not only compliance with the 40-hour work requirement of the institution, that's tracking one piece, but also we need a performance measure that tracks the number of inmates involved in an education activity. A performance measure.
And we can certainly break that down and reflect both of those, Madam Chair. Certainly, in Measure 17, the constitutional provision requires or allows compliance whether the individual is in work or in an appropriate program for that 40 hours. So what you're seeing here is a reflection of both of those things, and we can certainly break that down. What you'll find, I believe, when you see that broken down, is by and large a higher percentage are obviously involved in work programs because our opportunity for non-work related programs is substantially more limited than it might have been even at the time that Measure 17 was originally passed and assumed. But we can certainly break the data down and show you both and reflect both. Our programs piece is primarily, however, driven mostly by available resource.
I understand that, and I also understand the correlation, connection between work experience, educational opportunity, and reduced recidivism. So we need to have something, a performance measure, if you will, that's also tracking that set of activities, that are in addition to the 40-hour work education requirement under the constitutional mandate.
And Madam Chair,
is that clearer?
It is, and I think what you'll see is Mr. Zerniak is primarily reporting on only the performance measures that apply to the operations division. As Ms. Martin presents on the transitional services division, you'll see some applicable performance measures that may get to part of what you're looking for. If they don't get to everything you're looking for, Madam Chair, just please engage us again in this conversation.
Chair Gorley and members of the committee, the next performance measure is number 3, and that pertains to the percentage of inmates who complete the corrections plan. Ginger Martin is going to be covering that during her presentation, so I won't do that at this time. But I would like to move to performance measure number 6, which is the rate of Class 1 inmate assaults on staff per month.
Let's go back to the percentage of inmates corrections plan completed while at DLC. I want to make sure I understand what this is saying. Is this the number of plans actually written?
Chair Gorley, I believe what this is the number of corrections plans that have been completed by inmates at the time that they're released. And again, that's really more of a transition performance measure, and Ginger Martin's got, I think, a lot much more specific information on that.
please continue, but flag that one. We need to unpack what's going on here.
Thank you, Chair Burrow. The next one I'd like to talk about is the rate of Class 1 inmate assaults on staff per month. And as you can see, we have reduced that during the last time that we measured that, reduced the number of actual assaults. Now, clearly, one assault is one too many in the system. What we look at as an indicator, if those rates are going down, then we feel that this is an indication that our Oregon accountability model is, in fact, having some of the desired effect. But again, we won't be satisfied with anything less than zero assaults, and that's obviously a pretty difficult ideal to attain, but that's, I think, the direction that we obviously want to go. The next performance measure is on page 26, and that has to do with the rate of inmate walkaways from minimum custody institutions. As you can see, again, we have done considerably better in that than our target date, our target of one per 1,000. And we look at that as an indication of how well our classification system is working to ensure that we are putting the right risk level inmates into the proper institutions. The next performance measure has to do with the comparing the Department of Corrections health costs, healthcare costs per inmate as compared to the average Office of Medical Assistance programs. Even though the data looks pretty positive there, we've elected not to continue this performance measure because the constitutional requirements for what we have to provide by way of health care in a prison system is quite a bit different than what would be expected for the Oregon Medical Plan to health plan to provide. So we don't feel like that's really a good apples to apples comparison, and we will not be continuing that performance measure in the upcoming biennium. We also have several proposed performance measures that I'd like to review with you. The first one is performance measure number 10, and that relates to the number of sanctions imposed for level one misconducts. And what that really means is we want to get a handle on, again, how well the Oregon accountability model is working. If we're doing what we say we should do with that model, then those rates of misconduct should decrease. And those misconducts include serious assaults, drug distribution, and possession of dangerous weapons. The next performance measure that we'd like to add relates directly to our mission of protecting the public, and that is to track the number of escapes per year from secure custody armed perimeter institutions. And related to that is performance measure number 12, which is the number of escapes from minimum custody institutions. We want to have a separate measure for each in that there's quite a bit of difference in how we secure our high custody grade prisons compared to our minimum custody grade prisons. And this ends page 26. Please turn to page 27.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are no performance measures focused on professional development of staff. Has that been a consideration or a discussion?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have spent a considerable amount of time, actually just recently through a reorganization of our Human Resources Division and in general discussing the entire issue surrounding succession planning, professional development, training, and the like with respect to staff. What you have reflected in the performance measures you see in front of you, and we tried to do this in a way that was most meaningful to the committee, were those that were specifically directed to each of the divisions as they sort of present on their own primary performance measures. I can tell you off the top of my head, I don't believe we have a performance measure currently that is related to professional development of staff. We'd certainly be pleased to engage the committee in a discussion about how one might recommend we measure that and what that professional development would mean. our effort to some degree has been to truly measure performance and not simply just to measure activity. And so we, you know, we could certainly measure the number of people who have advanced into a particular position. We could measure the number of people who've attended certain kinds of training as one way to measure, from an activity-based standpoint, professional staff development. We're in the process internally right now of setting some, going through a process of developing our strategic plan for the next biennium. And staff and managerial development and leadership development is one of the key areas that we're considering. And we have proposed a number of different internal measures to try to track some of that. We'd be happy to share those with the chair and get some feedback if you'd be interested.
What I'm looking for, and perhaps this isn't a performance measure, but some information that would tell us what are the skills and abilities and competencies required of professionals, and I consider them professionals, required of these professionals working in institutions 21st century? And are we providing a quality of training that supports that?
And Madam Chair, I think you're hitting on an area that we're in the process ourselves, for purposes of our long-term strategic plan, developing and attempting to develop some of those very same measures. I think in the meeting you had several weeks ago, where this was actually the topic of a considerable period of time, we produced, I got to say, upwards of 20 different things that we talked about we could measure in an effort to try to make some of these determinations. It might be best, if it's with the chair's interest, that we package some of that up and get it to you and have you take a look at some of the things that we're talking about. We'll be clearly interested in getting feedback from you, and if you'd like, the entire committee, about what you think among those things we've identified might be the most useful.
Please do share them with the entire committee. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Gordley and members of the committee, I'd like to now address major budgetary issues. And what I really have to say about that really echoes many of the themes that have already been presented in this presentation. And specifically, they include managing effectively the anticipated growth of the prison population, the occupancy of newly constructed prison beds at Lakeview, and the addition of inmate housing at Coffee Creek and Shutter Creek, and also the mattress occupancy. Also, we're looking at continuing to restructure the institution operations to ensure that inmates are consistently engaged in work, training, treatment, and transitional programs as part of the Oregon accountability model. We also want to develop and implement effective strategies to manage an increasingly diverse inmate population that's characterized by longer prison sentences, increased mental health issues, increased numbers of elderly inmates, violence, gang-related activity in the inmate profile. We also have a challenge in terms of managing aging existing facilities with limited resources to address known deferred maintenance issues that total currently over $46 million. And just to give you a couple examples, we've got some institutions that need various improvements, such as windows. We've got institutions that have problems with the wastewater treatment, and just a host of issues that total $46 million. A huge issue for us is the compensation that we pay our health services staff, and that's not just in medical, but it also includes mental health, dental, pharmacy, particularly a huge issue in the area of nursing. We currently pay our health care providers on the average quite a bit less than what they can get from community health care organizations. This has created recruitment, staffing, and retention difficulties, some staff burnout, and I don't think we're at the point right now where we can say it impedes the delivery of health care, but it certainly puts additional strains on our ability to do that. And I think in the long term will in fact adversely affect our ability to provide the kind of health care services that we need to provide. What I'd like to tell the committee right now is that if you would turn from to page 30, all the information contained on the page 27 to 30 will be covered by Sue Acuff. And that's some very specific budget information at the conclusion of my presentation. I'd like to move to budget notes. The Department of Corrections received two notes from the 2003-2005 Ways and Means Committee. The first was Senate Bill 5509, which instructed the department to report to the First Emergency Board after September 1st on the progress it had made in controlling the use of overtime. The second directed the department to complete the development of staffing standards for non-security staff within all institutions for consideration during development and approval of our 2005-2007 budget. In the area of controlling overtime, after the first half of the biennium, the department had expended 54.5% of our overtime budget. The biggest issues that cause overtime are staff vacancies, sick leave, Family Medical Leave Act, hospital watches, military call-ups. Just to give you a brief example how that's impacted us with the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq, prior to 7103, we had three employees that were on active duty with the National Guard or Reserves. After 7103, we've averaged about 49 employees on active duty, and over half of these staff were employees of the Snake River Correctional Institution out next to Ontario. All of those factors together have combined to make it very, very difficult to stay within our overtime budget, although we have had some success recently in reducing the number of vacancies and also reducing the time that it takes to fill some of those vacancies. And we have seen in the last couple months a decrease in the amount of overtime that we have been spending.
Senator Devlin has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This particular item, obviously creating the budget note, was an extensive item of discussion during the last budget deliberation. Could you also give us something we had then so we could make a comparison of the overtime issues at each institution in terms of rates? Because I think that I don't remember if there were two or just one, but there was one institution that stood out amongst all of the institutions, and that was the Oregon State Penitentiary in terms of having a relatively high rate of overtime. And I'm wondering if we've ever looked at the issue of whether there is something cyclical about this in nature. Is that employees that end up doing a lot of overtime end up utilizing, is there anything that would say that they end up utilizing more of their sick time, etc., in the sense that if you're, I've actually known some of your staff that have put in 100 hours a month consistently in overtime, at least a few. And that can wear on a person after a while, so.
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin will be happy to get you those comparisons by institutions. We do have that data.
And can we get the 01 biennium rates as compared to this biennium rates in those institutions?
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin will be happy to get that for you.
If I could verify something as well, on page 31 in that last paragraph at the top part of the page, say in the last few months of 2004, however, we have seen reductions in overtime, partly due to renewed and improved efforts in the recruitment of new security staff. It's now April 2005. Is that still holding true?
Chair Gorley and members of the committee, I would say yes, that is true. I haven't seen our overtime figures yet for March, but I can tell you that February we were down. Oh, I'm sorry. You asked about specifically about vacancies. I think that definitely was down in February.
No, I was asking about reductions in overtime,
partly
due to renewed and improved efforts in the recruitment of new security staff, reading from your page.
Right, Senator Gorley. What I meant when I said reduction of overtime, that's exactly what I was referring to. If we keep our vacancies down, then our overtime tends to be down also. We have developed several strategies to control overtime. The first is that we implemented an automated data system used by institution staff that is under the oversight of a centralized staff deployment coordinator. And basically what this means is that in very close to real time, we can look at any given institution to see how they're using and how they're deploying their staff to make sure that that's done as efficiently as can do. The second is we have implemented an annual staffing analysis department-wide that reviews institutions' use and deployment of staff. We've, in addition, developed standards through the revision of the department's policy on staff deployment that really gives staff more specific guidelines on how they should be implementing staffing and scheduling changes. We've also developed and implemented a report form that documents the cost of significant events and emergencies in an institution setting. And why that's important is that in the past when we had a disturbance or we had a food strike and we had to put additional staff on duty to ensure safety around an institution and also other staff on alert, we had no way to capture how well we were doing that, if that was being done effectively and efficiently, and what that was costing us. Now we've got a process that any time we have an unusual circumstance like that, we are able to translate our response into what that cost us. And we can certainly use that for training our administrators and subordinate managers. We've also developed and are expanding a centrally scheduled hospital watch system that combines security staff from several institutions with transport staff. Rather than just having one institution handle all of their transports and escorts hospital watch situation, if there's other staff that are available at another institution, we're looking at ways to be able to combine that as a pool and use those that total resource more effectively. We're, as I mentioned earlier, working with human resources, and I think we're having some success to address our vacancy rates and to accelerate the hiring process. And then finally, consistent with a Secretary of State audit that I think Senator Devin was referring to at the Oregon State Penitentiary, we are requesting, as a part of Policy Package 132, authority to establish 27 security positions that we would take out of anticipated savings to overtime by establishing more escort positions so that we don't have to pay overtime when we have some of the needs that we have. Please turn to page 33. I'd like to conclude this presentation by talking about non-security staffing standards. What we've done with that is used a net zero approach to reallocating existing staff resources, thus ensuring the most equitable distribution possible within our institutions. So the final result of this is that the department is not asking for any additional non-security staff, but is first reallocating existing staff. And as a result of this exercise, 17 positions were recommended for reallocation, and you can see on your final page a listing of those positions, the type of positions, what institutions they were taken from, what institutions they were reassigned to as part of the staffing standards exercise. And with that, Senator Chair Gordley and members of the committee, this concludes my presentation, and I'd be willing to answer any questions any further questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zerniak. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Gorley and committee.
Madam Chair, if it's your pleasure, this would be the point where we would have Ms. Acuff actually talk you through the operations division budget detail that you find on page 28 and 29.
Madam Chair and members, I am Sue Acuff, Department of Corrections, for the record. And on page 28, you'll see just very general information on what was in the governor's recommended budget. And up there at the top in the box, you'll see essentially what has happened from the 03-05 legislative adopted to the governor's rec. And it's there that you'll see the shift away from the federal funds, which were the one-time monies given to the Department of Corrections for this current biennium. That's very reflective of what that change is. That is the major change that you'll see in this particular section of the budget. The base budget changes, I think Mr. Wilson talked to some of those in talking about the Attorney General rate. In that, you'll find a significant PERS rate increase. You'll find the one additional merit that is assumed in the governor's budget. Operations division giving as large as it is, those are significant numbers. In total, between one and two there, that's about $38 million on the general fund side. Then on the essential packages, as you find with all other agencies, we do have in part of package 10, in addition to inflationary factors, you do have the PERS pension obligation bond liability, which for DOC is again substantial. That's 17 point almost 9 million in general fund right there. In addition, let's see, on package 21, these are non-personnel driven costs mostly. That particular package reflects rental bed needs, not only the contracts there, but the addition for food, for inmate care, that kind of activity. In package 22, this is basically roll-up costs for the emergency beds and the expansion costs that we had current biennium. That's bringing on the expansion at Powder River and South Fork. Then moving to package 30, there's kind of an offset here. Part of what used to be budgeted in services and supplies for the pension bond obligation is taken out of here and was put back into the package we spoke to earlier. Then we do have inflationary factors for extraordinary medical inflation. All of those are showing in package 30. And then in package 40, this is the one which will significantly change for you by the time we get to the work session. This brings on essentially the population management packages. This was based on the October of 2004 forecast. When we get to the 2005 April forecast, this is where the co-chair's budget has picked up, I believe it was $10.5 million in savings. We can walk you through what those changes are. Today, this reflects what the governor's budget had. Then on package 50, this is where the reversal of the one-time federal monies occurred. Those essentially are all the base elements to what happened. Then in the governor's adjustment packages, I believe Linda Gilbert spoke the first day to a couple of things that we'll need to fix in a work session. There's some technical adjustments that have to happen, and those reflect the first three that are here. The $2 million general fund reduction for alcohol and drug, $500,000 for COG on the education side, and $275,000 for the Women and Community Services programs. Those reductions were all assumed in the governor's budget, only they were reflected in the operations division, and they should be reflected in transitional services, and that's what Ginger Martin will speak to next. That will be a technical change that you'll see there. Ginger will speak to the actual programmatic impact to that. Then we have some minor changes, if you will, $617,000 for changing in nursing services. Part of this reflects a 90-day delay in hiring. There's a potential to establish, if I'll call it like a substitute nurse pool, much like substitute teachers. That's the intention there. Elimination of inflation for the $2.3 million. Then we have an $860,000 reduction for travel. There's hospital watch changes in here, which Mr. Zerniak just spoke to try and eliminate overtime and go to straight time on some of that supervision cost. And finally, there was hope to establish a work camp, and I believe we do have some opportunity here. It may be a little less than $300,000, but it would be additional work for the U.S. Forest Service in doing trail and signage work. Then I'm now moving to the top of page 30. for the final minor adjustments here. There's an Employment Relations Board rate change, which is tiny for even a budget our size. There's some audit adjustments. There were some one-time startup equipment at the new facilities, which had been, it was a mistake. When we actually did the governor's request or our agency request, the governor did backfill that for us. Those are basically inmate care items for Coffee Creek. And then your Smart Buy projected savings of $224,000. And then finally, there is one policy package, and that was the staffing that Mr. Zerniak just spoke to. That was the establishment of 27 new security positions funded directly by the reduction of overtime. And that's the dollar amount there is a little bit over $4 million. It's a very brief description. Description. I'd like to say my words here. I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions, comments?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Aiko.
And Ms. Martin, we welcome you and look forward to your presentation. And I would ask, because there's concern about the governor's package, also in the co-chair's package, a reduction of those prison programs, the $2 million general fund from alcohol and drug programs, $500,000 general fund funding for the cognitive education programs, and the $275,000 general fund to fully eliminate the Women and Community Services program, that the department consider what other options you have for further cutting costs in order to bring back the programs, the prison programs, which would be $2,775,000.
Please continue.
Thank you. Chair Gordley, members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin, an assistant director for the Department of Corrections responsible for transitional services. Thank you for your time this afternoon as I present the budget for the Transitional Services Division. I will be as concise as I can, but I am happy to stop at any time that you'd like a little more detail about any of the subject areas.
Thank you.
Chair, there's another tab further on called Transitional Services in the notebook.
Representative Hansen?
Well, just taking up on the point that my chair has made, in terms of other cuts to replace those three programs, I would think that, just kind of my sense of where the committee might go, that that's probably real important. Those programs are incredibly important in this committee, and there probably needs to be some alternatives. And I would certainly leave it up to the department what those are, but I think we'll probably need alternatives for those three programs before.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen would be pleased to engage the committee in a discussion and provide you some information. Obviously, the budget that we're presenting to you is the governor's recommended budget, and that requires also that we have conversations with the governor's office about where they would like us to go if we're going to go off script and do a bit of freelancing. But we would be happy to have that conversation both with you and with the governor's office about other alternatives that you might wish us to consider.
We will appreciate that. Again, this is a subcommittee that understands the link between having those programs in place and opportunities to reduce recidivism, and needing to weigh that in the balance as well.
Chair Gordon, members of the committee, the Transitional Services Division does play a significant role in the successful transition of inmates as they reenter community living after incarceration. The division contributes to the reintegration through community supervision and by addressing criminal risk factors, including those related to alcohol and drug problems, antisocial thinking, lack of educational or vocational achievement, family problems, and lack of social support. The division impacts over 30,000 felony offenders in the community and over 12,700 inmates in state prisons. The division operates under one assistant director and is further organized into four major areas. Those are community corrections, workforce development, religious services, and offender sentence computation and records. I think that the work of this committee relates very closely with the priorities of the work of the division, relates closely to the priorities that you've set as a subcommittee. We contribute to Oregon's Have a Right to be Safe through community supervision by providing programs that reduce recidivism, future crimes, and future crime victims. We manage the accountability of the process so that when offenders from other states move into Oregon, we know who they are and how best to manage them. And we provide services to crime victims, particularly information that notifies crime victims when an offender is moving into or out of incarceration or to another location. The second priority, that state government should be stable, responsive, and accountable. We do that, I think, or contribute to that through accurate sentence computation so that offenders are serving the terms that they were given by the court. We support local decision-making and planning in local criminal justice system management and community corrections. We provide jail inspections. And we use the results of research to improve the programming that we offer. As far as access to justice and respect for diversity, I think that we contribute to that as we look more and more objectively and less subjectively at who goes to the prison programs that we have. In other words, we're using more objective measures for risk and criminal risk factors in knowing who needs to be prioritized to go into the limited programs that we have. Another area, related area, in religious services, we have made an enormous effort in the last couple of years to provide religious services to a broad array of both minority and majority religions, and we've seen a significant drop in the kind of lawsuits that come with lack of that kind of access. The division operates under a number of statutes, statutory authorities and constitutional authorities. Oregon law requires that we provide education, that we provide chaplaincy services, that we administer the Community Corrections Act, and that we administer the Interstate Compact for the transfer of adult offenders on supervision. This is that part of state law that is also in agreement with 49 and maybe 50 other states at this point, in which we've agreed how we will hold offenders accountable and manage information as they move from state to state. The Oregon Constitution, of course, requires that we respect the right to religious freedom, and that impacts what we do in prison in terms of making religious experiences available to inmates. The Constitution also requires that we provide alcohol and drug treatment to selected inmates, and it requires that sentences be fully served, which means that our sentence computation unit needs to do their job accurately. On page 5 and 6 are the organizational charts that show the division in 0305 and also 0507. You will notice that 62 positions have been added between this biennium and next. Those are primarily because of taking over the operation for the Douglas County and Linn County Community Corrections Offices. So 48 of those positions are field positions. The remaining positions are attached to the expected growth in the new institutions. Some of them are sentence computation and prison record staff, and there are a few religious services staff added as well to take care of the new population.
Senator Devlin?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. A clarification on the two counties that opted out, Douglas County and Linn County. Trying to gain an understanding here. They opted out. We are currently performing some of the probation, I don't like the new term, but the post-prison supervision. Are we also, did we take responsibility for the incarceration of state sentenced under 1 year's time? And if we did, are they still housed in that county, or are they housed elsewhere? And are we what rate are we compensating the county if they're housed within the county?
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, when the county opts out of community corrections, the state assumes responsibility for every population in the community. So that means probation, parole, post-prison supervision, and that group that are typically called local control, the group of offenders who are serving a prison term of 12 months or less. They still serve those terms locally. We have a contract with the sheriff in each of those counties to provide us with jail bed space. I believe in Linn County that contract is for $64 a day.
Clarification. Is that contract at a similar rate in terms of the incarceration that we were paying prior?
Chair Gorley, Senator Devlin, that rate is based on the statewide rate for local control offenders, so it's consistent just in terms of estimating cost from county to county.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there are no changes in the actual community corrections dollars going to either of those counties. We distribute dollars for community corrections based on a formula that is the same for each county based on the workload in the county, and each jurisdiction decides how best to manage their resources and their offenders.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Just sort of basis of clarification. When we were discussing this item in the last session, I think the arrangements that have been made are probably working well, at least that's my parents. But there was a discussion that counties couldn't really opt out selectively from the elements in terms of they couldn't opt out from just the incarceration of 1145 inmates, or rather they had to opt out completely. Is that because of statutory reasons?
Senator Gurley, Senator Devlin, that is pretty clear in statute. The groups of offenders for whom counties are responsible are listed, and when a county opts out, that whole group kind of moves over to state responsibility.
Okay.
Please continue.
Okay, I'd like now to move into a little more detail about the four major areas of the Transitional Services Division, and that will be on page 7. The Transitional Services Division makes up 20% of the DOC budget. However, 80% of those funds, or 16% of the whole DOC budget, are actually sent out to county jurisdictions to operate community corrections. So 4% of the DOC budget is used to provide programs and sentence computation. Community corrections supervision and programs are provided, as you know, directly by the state in the two counties, Linn and Douglas, and through intergovernmental agreement with the remaining counties. The Central Administration Unit provides oversight to community corrections and administers the Community Corrections Act, monitors compliance with laws and rules, and the intergovernmental agreement. The budget drivers for that unit are the statutorily mandated duties and the duties that require some centralized coordination to make the decentralized system work well, and the field offices directly operated by the department. This unit also operates the Interstate Compact, and as I mentioned earlier, this is the agreement between all of the states that governs how offenders move across state lines safely. The budget driver for this particular unit is the number of applications for transfer of supervision in and out of Oregon, which has remained fairly stable over the years, and it's about even as far as how many offenders move into Oregon and how many move out. We are now managing, however, misdemeanors moving into Oregon. That's a new workload for us. Also, the new compact, which went into effect in August, has some additional rules, and so we have seen some workload increase in trying to manage the new rules made by the National Commission. Community Corrections Grant and Aid is also part of this budget unit. This is what is typically called Senate Bill 1145 grant funding. These are the dollars that go out to each of the community corrections jurisdictions, and they support activities like evaluating each offender's likelihood to commit a new crime, monitoring those offenders according to their behavior and their risk to reoffend. In other words, those at higher risk to reoffend or whose behavior is worse get watched a little closer. Community corrections agencies employ a continuum of community-based sanctions to use when offenders violate the conditions of their supervision. For example, they use community service work. They may use work release. They may use electronic home detention, day reporting centers, and even short jail stays. Community corrections agencies also offer programs designed to address the causes of criminal behavior, such as alcohol and drug treatment and sex offender treatment. And finally, those agencies incarcerate offenders locally who previously served 12 months or less in a state prison. The budget drivers for community corrections grant and aid can be found primarily in the growth of the felony population as forecast by the Office of Economic Analysis. The populations have been fairly stable over the years. Probation is expected to grow about 2.5% in the next biennium, post-prison supervision by about 4.5%, and the local control population by about 6%.
Ms. Martin, could you move that microphone just a tad back toward? Yeah. Just got a little echo.
Yes.
Thank you.
Next major unit as part of the Transitional Services Division is the Workforce Development Unit. The purpose of this
Representative
Wilson. Maybe before we go forward on past community corrections, could you give us the minute version of the differences between the governor's budget and the, I'll characterize it as the additional $9 million that counties want to get to the stay above the opt-out level, and then the $18 million, which is sort of the full funding package. How we got to those different...
Chair Gordley, Representative Hanson, I'm not sure that I can answer the actual question you asked, but I may be able to provide some information that would be helpful. There are essentially two methods right now being talked about as to how the statewide budget would be built as a baseline budget and non-opt-out budget. And one of those amounts is $190 million, and that is using the traditional method, the method we've been using to forecast and cost out community corrections populations for, I don't know, maybe 6 years now, drives to a number of $190 million in the April forecast. In the governor's budget, he's proposed a different method of building the statewide budget that's been called the band model. Uses the same Office of Economic Analysis, still does a forecast, and we actually use the same case rates, but the populations that are forecast are a little different. So with the band model, you're looking at everybody who was initially sentenced to probation in one group and everybody who was initially sentenced to prison in another group. And we develop a per-head cost for both of those groups. It's reminiscent of a capitated rate in healthcare, in which you know some individuals are going to cost a lot of money to manage and other individuals are healthy and they're not going to need anything from your system. Same thing is true in corrections. So when we use that model, and at the same time what's happened, to make this more complicated, is we took another look at the capitated rates to update them to current practice. The ones we'd been using and were used in the governor's budget to look at the band model were based on practices in 99, around that time. And we have changed slightly the profile of those populations, the probation group and the post-prison group, changed very slightly. But they changed mostly in the area of local control, very expensive population, so a small change there did make a difference in the capitated rate. For probation, it went down about a dollar a day. For post-prison, it went up slightly. When you feed the new rates in to the forecast, you get a number of about $182 million. So I think those are the two numbers that have been being looked at pretty critically, the 190 and the 182. Both of them are based on a corrections forecast, but we come about estimating the cost a little differently. I think one of the reasons you see a difference is that when you use the band model, you sort of peg a rate right now, and if the local control population goes up a bit, it's not going to capture that. Also, if it drops a bit, it's not going to capture that. The reason people like it is it levels out the fluctuation that we have seen in that very small, very expensive group of local control offenders. So I hope that was more than a minute, but I hope that more or less answered the question you were asking.
Probably a minute was unrealistic.
Madam Chair, I have a handout that I put together for the co-chairs on this. It is rather confusing because there's no easy way to really explain this, mm-hmm. but either during work session I can meet with folks separately to go through that, but it is the House co-chair budget restores it back to the $190 million, and the Senate version restores it back to
70-something.
Yeah, so it doesn't get it back. It only gets it halfway to the 181 mm-hmm. is the difference. So
those the dueling chairs budgets.
Whatever we're calling them, I'm not sure. So basically, under the House budget, there isn't an option for opting out, regardless whether it's 181 or 190. In the Senate budget, they are under the opt-out threshold is what I'll call it, and so counties could choose to opt out at this time.
Does that take care of your question and the response?
Okay. I'm sure it will come up again.
No doubt.
Okay, the Workforce Development Unit has as a specific purpose to increase the employability of inmates after they're released and to reduce their criminal behavior and recidivism by addressing alcohol and drug addiction, by increasing their literacy, by developing workforce skills and good work habits, and by developing productive and pro-social attitudes. Education programs within the Department of Corrections make up 1.5% of the entire DOC budget. Over 52% of inmates who come into our intake center lack either functional literacy, which means they are not up to the 8th grade level, or they don't have a GED or a high school diploma.
Ms. Martin, in the prior paragraph, there's a statement that approximately 66% of those who enter with a basic education need are served prior to release. What does served mean in this context?
Chair Gurley, that means about 66% of the group that I just described actually get service while they are with us. So that group of inmates who either don't have a credential or are not functionally literate.
And again, served means what in terms of outcome? The 66% get what?
Chair Gurley, that means that they received some educational service. It doesn't mean that they completed a credential, for example. As of March 2005, 745 inmates had earned a GED while they were in prison. But the majority of our folks are not at the level at which they can even pursue a GED. In other words, about 75% of inmates who receive education are receiving adult basic education or English as a second language. They're not prepared yet to even pursue a GED.
Looking at the information that you're providing on functional literacy, with the 52% of inmates at intake lack functional literacy, are you also tracking percentages at discharge in terms of what that looks like?
Senator Gurley, I don't believe we are tracking that, but I know that that information is available to us in our system. And I should take a moment to clarify the 52% is made up of both those who are below the level of functional literacy and or are missing a GED. So 24% are functionally illiterate and 28% lack a GED. The combined percentage then is 52%.
But we don't have any information currently on what those percentages look like at discharge.
Chair Gorley, I have not seen that information, and so I'm thinking we perhaps haven't looked at our data in that way, but we can. We do know that participation in education reduces the likelihood of reconviction by 15% to 20%. In Oregon data, there's lots of good national data as well that speaks to the importance of this kind of program in reducing recidivism. We do still operate a small work-based education function in the department in which classroom curriculum and real-life work components are combined to teach skills in areas like computer careers, construction trades, carpentry, housing construction, automotive, hairstyling, dispensing, optician.
And again, the percentage of inmates who have the opportunity to participate in that activity is what?
Chair Gordley, I have so many facts and figures here, and I don't think I have that particular one. I know I have all the components, so we can get that for you.
What I'm trying to do is compare and contrast the opportunity that's mandated versus whatever else may be offered that inmates are taking advantage of.
Chair Gordley, it will be a small percentage. We have 140 slots available in work-based education, and I believe about 300 to 350 inmates actually receive that kind of assistance every year. So it'll be a very small percentage. The next area in workforce development would be our cognitive and behavioral programs. These programs are based on the idea that criminal thinking patterns produce criminal behavior, and that by changing the thinking, we thus change the behavior. Criminal attitudes or thinking are, as an example, blaming others for one's misfortune, a sense that you have been unfairly treated in some way which justifies your aggression or stealing. A super optimism in which you believe that you will never get caught. See, many of us have versions of these kinds of attitudes, but not to the degree that criminals do. I mean, they are not human kinds of attitudes, but criminal offenders tend to have this kind of thinking more often than the rest of us do, and in greater degree.
And so this is a program that's targeted at offenders who supposedly can benefit from the approach. What percentage of the population is that?
26% of inmates have a high criminal risk factor related to antisocial attitudes. In other words, we, in our assessment, determined that it is antisocial thinking contributing to their criminal behavior. And they also have a high risk to reoffend.
Is that 26% of the current population?
26% of the current population.
And is this program available to 26% of the current population?
Chair Gordley, I did some kind of analysis about the treatment need. These programs, as we are redesigning them to make them more effective, will be a 12-week long intervention. Given this group of high-risk, high-need inmates that we would want to target with this particular program, we would need 464 treatment slots.
And you have...
And we have, after we make the changes that we are planning to make, 375.
And this is an evidence-based best practice.
Chair Gordley, I'm happy to say that we have assessed this program using the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory, which is a fidelity tool to the evidence-based research that we are trying to move toward, and it scored very satisfactory. Fewer than 5% of programs scored on this tool score that high, so I can tell you that it is operating as an evidence-based program.
So is that to say we know it works, but we just don't make it available to everyone because we can't afford to do that?
Chair Gorley, I think we can say without a doubt that we know it works. In fact, we also have some DOC research that looked at the reduction for those programs in recidivism and found that when we pair both Pathfinders and Thinking for a Change, the two of the three that we were operating, they do reduce recidivism by 20%.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know how difficult it would be to get this information for us. So if it's impossible or nearly impossible, don't do it. But in terms of things like the literacy program, where we only have 66% receive the services that they should be getting, can you break down the reasons why they're not, either length of stay or whether the programs aren't offered in the particular institution that they're in? The same thing for the cognitive behavior program. You're saying that the need is for the appropriate inmates would be, was it 480 slots, and we have 370 or something like that?
Is
that just a slot problem, or is it also an institutional problem that maybe there are people that are in the wrong institution at the wrong time, and that type of an issue?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hansen, let me correct my my capacity figure is 435 is what we anticipate to have available for next
year. Corrected. I think I was the one that was trying to take it back, but whatever the range is,
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we can certainly do some of that gap analysis and try to identify some of the rationale. It is challenging, obviously, with so many inmates moving through the system. They are assessed at intake. A variety of things can sometimes intervene that prevents, even if there is an available bed, an individual with a need from getting into a program. Everything from the program being offered in an institution that doesn't also have the same level of medical care necessary, so the inmate can't be at the institution where the program is offered because they can't support the medical situation. An inmate who might have the need but might also have a co-occurring disorder from a mental health standpoint and not be suitable based on that rationale to be involved in a program. Or an inmate who's got a behavioral challenge and may need to be in the intensive management unit or in the disciplinary segregation unit and simply needs the program but isn't behaving sufficiently well enough to participate in it. That combined with a reduction in the number of beds available to meet the expanding population probably accounts for a variety of those issues. And we can certainly look and see if there is something more definitive we can put around those to give you some greater sense of why that is.
Yeah, because if it's, I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on, if it's a case of hiring two more people to expand, that's one type of a problem. If it's updating medical facilities in every institution we have, that's a lot more expensive of a process. So I'm trying to get a sense of what some steps would cost to get us closer to filling those gaps.
And what we might do, we can certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, kick this around when we get back to the office. What we might end up doing to give you some sense is to pull perhaps a random sample of those who been identified with the need but haven't been in the program and kind of get a sense of what the breakdowns are. I think it would be very difficult for us, I think, to review each individual's case file inmate by inmate. But if we can pull somewhat of a random sample and look at it and then come back to you with at least some good hypothesis about what that's showing us and what we think the rationale is.
Theoretically, if we looked at these programs in terms of a program that you can substantiate a 20% lower recidivism rate, we might be able to project some savings into the population forecast and fund the expansion of the programs based on what we expect to save from it.
We have.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Just thinking, there was an immediate silence that befell our our staff when I finish that last statement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we have no doubt that these programs are both evidence-based and they're cost-effective when one considers the reduction in recidivism. The average recidivating inmate that comes back to the Department of Corrections stays for approximately 3 years and costs the department $72,000, just the department, not counting the costs associated at the county level, local law enforcement, post-prison supervision upon release, and the like. And most importantly, given that this is Crime Victims Week, the innocent victim that's been now victimized and the impact that it's had on that individual before they've come back into the system. So you won't get any argument, I think, from any of us at the table or anybody in the department that additional investment in these kind of cognitive treatment programs will save you resources in the long run. There's just no question about it. And we believe it's the right thing to do.
We do have about 3 minutes remaining, and so I'm going to suggest that we stop at this point and begin tomorrow with the alcohol and drug treatment programs. But, Ms. Martin, I do want to make sure that we get our numbers correct. You initially said that you need 464 slots, but I think you adjusted that to 435. Is that correct?
Chair Gormley, the need is 464 if we target those higher risk, higher need offenders. The planned treatment capacity next biennium is 435.
And Madam Chair, if I could just, I know you're trying to close up, but if I could emphasize a comment that Ms. Martin said. She talked about targeting the high-risk, high-need offenders. We use a risk-based model. There are substantially more than that number who would benefit from cognitive behavioral programs. But as you get up into the category of high-risk, high-need, we put the resources where we believe they're going to provide the biggest bang for the buck and create the best level of public safety. But as you move down, there are certainly higher risk offenders that still could benefit from this program that she's not including in those numbers. And if you want a breakdown of the various categories of need and risk, we'd be happy to provide that to you in a written form.
Very good. And speaking of written form, I do want to acknowledge that the director and the staff have provided answers to questions raised at the meeting back on April 7th. As I was scanning through, it appears that there's a page missing from the testimony provided to the Senate Health Policy Committee. It's the document dated March 28, 2005, regarding testimony on Senate Bill 704. We have the first page of the testimony, but it looks like there's a second page missing. I'm going to request that because the questions asked by the committee were very important, that we spend some time tomorrow after Ms. Martin's presentation going through the responses to the questions, if you will, Director Williams. For example, there was the question related to the federal, state, criminal, so-called alien assistance program. I do not like that word, alien. And the gap between funding and the cost of housing those individuals, that's a really critical question. So if you would just plan on walking through those, that would be great. For the good of the order, colleagues, just a reminder that Tuesday and Wednesday we continue with the Department of Corrections. Public testimony scheduled for Wednesday. Wednesday's hearing is scheduled to last until 4 p.m., and we will be meeting in Hearing Room D on that day. And then also on that Wednesday, that is also the day that the full Ways and Means Committee will be meeting up in Portland at the Portland Community College Cascade campus, so you'll want to adjust your schedules and calendars for that. And then on Thursday, the military department is scheduled for phase one and two presentations. Director Williams and staff, thank you. And Representative Hansen?
Are there any other ways to meet public hearings?
Yes. There is a schedule being developed through the president's office. I would encourage you to be in touch there.
That schedule is out and posted now. It's extensive. Beginning Wednesday night. And then there's about six Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. Wednesday in Portland, Friday in Medford, Saturday in Klamath Falls. It's an extensive list.
We will have that calendar tomorrow, and pack your bags. Meeting adjourned. Thank you very much.